own office. Eventually, and only after considerable pressure, Addington relented and allowed me to be briefed. In the middle of February 2004, I found myself in a Justice Department secure conference room with the director of the National Security Agency, Air Force General Michael Hayden, getting from him a long-awaited briefing on the highly classified surveillance program. Hayden was an impeccably dressed, amiable man, with wire-rimmed glasses, a bald head, and a talent for folksy sayings and Pittsburgh Steeler references. As we sat down at the table, the general offered a preamble that I will never forget. "I'm so glad you are getting read into this program," he said, "so that when John Kerry is elected president, I won't be alone at the green table." The reference to congressional testimony, behind a table that is often green, was jarring. What was this man about to tell me that required him to express his joy that I would join him in a congressional grilling once a new president arrived? And why on earth would he say such a thing to the second-ranking official of the United States Department of Justice? I had no time to do more than think these questions, because General Hayden plowed right into his briefing. His way of mixing folksy aphorisms and NSA speak was both entertaining and reassuring. The problem, I would come to realize, was that his briefings were a river of really great-sounding stuff that didn't make much sense once the briefing was over and you tried to piece together what you had just heard. After Hayden departed, my Justice Department colleagues, Jack Goldsmith and Patrick Philbin, visibly exhaled. They then explained to me how the surveillance program actually worked and why so much of it was totally screwed up as a matter of both law and practice. The NSA was doing stuff, they maintained, that had no legal basis because it didn't comply with a law Congress had passed a generation earlier, which governed electronic surveillance inside the United States. The president was violating that statute in ordering the surveillance. The NSA was also doing other stuff that wasn't even in the president's orders, so nobody had authorized it at all. This wasn't General Hayden's fault. He wasn't a lawyer or a technologist, and, like Attorney General Ashcroft, who was prohibited from discussing the program even with his personal staff, Hayden was strictly limited in who he could consult about the program. The program was set up as a short-term response to a national emergency, because even Addington knew this was an extraordinary assertion of presidential power, so the president's orders were for short periods, usually about 6 weeks. The current presidential order expired on March 11th. Goldsmith had told the White House that he could not support its reauthorization. Given what I knew, I had to ensure that my boss had all the facts. Many times over the past 2+ years, Ashcroft had approved Stellar Wind, and he needed to know that had been a mistake and could not continue. On Thursday, March 4th, 2004, I met alone with Attorney General Ashcroft to tell him in detail about the problems with the program and why we could not approve another extension. We ate lunch together at a small table in his office. I brought my own store-bought sandwich and butcher paper. It was either turkey or tuna. I was so busy in those days that my assistant, Linda Long, held my money and followed my instructions to alternate those two sandwiches forever. The Attorney General had a fancier setup from his chef, which was good, because I needed the salt and pepper shakers and pieces of silverware to represent parts of the program. I showed him which pieces we could make reasonable arguments to support and which we simply couldn't and that would need to stop or be changed. Ashcroft listened carefully. At the end of the lunch, he said the analysis made sense to him and we should fix the program to be consistent with the law. I told him we had been keeping the White House informed and I would now march out and execute on his authority. After our lunch, Ashcroft headed to the United States Attorney's Office across the Potomac in Alexandria to do a press event. He never made it. He collapsed and was rushed to George Washington University Hospital in the District of Columbia with acute pancreatitis, an extraordinarily painful ailment that can also be fatal. By this time, I had gotten on a commercial flight to Phoenix for a government meeting. I learned of the Attorney General's condition as I walked off the plane. My chief of staff, Chuck Rosenberg, called to tell me that with Ashcroft incapacitated, I was now the acting Attorney General and needed to be back in Washington. They were sending a government plane to retrieve me. Back in Washington, I met on Friday with Goldsmith and Philbin. They had communicated the Department of Justice position to the White House. The renewal date was March 11th, 1 week away, and we were not going to support a renewal in the program's current form. That weekend, Goldsmith was summoned to meet with Gonzales in Addington, but no progress was made. Gonzales was, as usual, pleasant. Addington was, as usual, angry. Neither man could explain to Goldsmith why we were wrong. Goldsmith had also informed them that I had assumed the duties of the Attorney General. On Tuesday, March the 9th, I was summoned to a meeting at the White House in Chief of Staff Andrew Card's office. Card was a pleasant man who was usually quiet in meetings I attended. He saw his role as ensuring that the process supporting the president worked. He was not an advisor, at least not in my experience. Goldsmith and Philbin were with me. The vice president was presiding. He was sitting at the head of the conference table. I was offered a seat to his immediate left. Also at the table were General Hayden, Card, Gonzales, FBI Director Bob Mueller, and senior CIA officials. Goldsmith and Philbin found chairs at the far end, down to my left. David Addington stood, leaning against a windowsill behind the table. The first part of the meeting was a presentation by NSA personnel using charts to show me how valuable the surveillance program had been in connection with an ongoing Al-Qaeda plot in the United Kingdom. The intelligence collected had produced a link chart that showed connections among members of a terrorist cell. That was important stuff. Of course, I knew enough about the matter to have serious doubts about whether the NSA's program was needed to find those links, given the other legal tools we had. Still, I said nothing. Our concerns were not based on the usefulness of the program. That was for others to decide. Our job was to certify that the program had a reasonable basis in law. After the analysts rolled up their charts and left the room, the vice president took over. He and I were sitting close enough to touch knees, with Addington out of focus behind Cheney. The vice president looked at me gravely and said that, as I could plainly see, the program was very important. In fact, he said, thousands of people are going to die because of what you are doing. The air in the room felt thin. It was obvious that the purpose of this meeting was to squeeze me, although nobody said that. To have the Vice President of the United States accuse me of recklessly producing another 9/11, even seeming to suggest that I was doing it intentionally, was stunning. He didn't want to hear another side. He didn't seem to accept the obvious truth that there was another side. To him, he was right. Everyone else was wrong, and a bunch of weak-willed and probably liberal lawyers weren't going to tell him otherwise. My head was swimming, the blood rushing to my cheeks in anger, but I regained my footing. "That's not helping me," I said. "That makes me feel bad, but it doesn't change the legal analysis. I accept what you say about how important it is. Our job is to say what the law can support, and it can't support the program as it is." Cheney then expressed a frustration that was entirely reasonable.